You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face, incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel where two guys cover horror, science fiction, movies, television, series, literature, all kinds of those genre-related things, key influences in those particular subjects of the week, and then things that those subjects have influenced themselves, key elements that come from them. We've been doing it for quite a few seasons now. If you're new to us, thank you for joining. We appreciate you finding us. Would love to hear how you found us. Leave us a comment down below there, or do, you know, your typical thing that you do where you subscribe, and or that way you learn when we're doing new episodes or everything else. Visit our website, which has all of our past episodes on it. And if you're recurring and returning to us, a recurring victim, thank you for coming back. We appreciate you being here. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend, Tim. Hey, Tim, what you been doing?
Hey, David. What have I been doing? My goodness. Well, we usually talk about something we've done in our genre week, our respective genre week. Yep. And I got around finally to watching the 2023 Fango Chainsaw Awards.
Oh, well, those are massively important.
Yes. They are extremely important because it shows me that we're on the right track. Usually when we're talking about viewings and things coming to get people, you will be happy to know that The Black Phone and the movie Prey and the movie Terrifier 2 were the top winners in the Fango Awards. By the way, I'm going to give some things away, folks, while I talk about this.
So spoilers.
If you haven't seen these, you're going to know they won something.
Yeah.
The Black Phone run, you know, that was one of my favorite movies of last year. It won best screenplay, best actor for the kid, Mason Thames, and best wide release. So out of a lot of major things that were out there, including the Ty West movies, this beat them.
Wow. We should do that. We should have that on our list.
Well, it was on our list, but I replaced it with a Ty West movie.
Ah, okay, then. There you go.
How soon he forgets. And we're not going to say what that is because that's supposed to be a surprise, folks.
Yeah.
However, first feature went to the movie Watcher, the movie with Micah Monroe that I told you about.
That you loved.
Yes.
Yes.
Cinematography and directing went to Jordan Peele for Nope.
Makes sense.
I mean, yeah, it's a big budget. And I mean, it is a pretty movie. Speak No Evil, which is a movie that's been on my list, but I haven't watched it, won Best Foreign Release. And it's on Shudder, so I'm probably going to watch it sooner now that I know it won an award. I mentioned Prey. It won for creature effects, costumes, and streaming, you know, because it went directly to streaming.
Right.
Terrifier 2 won best limited release, best makeup, and best kill. You're going to love this one. Pennywise, the story of It, won best documentary. And 101 scariest movie moments of all time won best docuseries.
Wow.
And excellent. We talked about both of those.
Yep.
And then Ty West had a double dose because X and Pearl came out within the same year. It didn't win as much, but Mia Goth did win for best actress.
Makes sense.
So, and I think that's everything. I was wanting to give just a little bitty synopsis of it. And that's about it. But if for anyone out there that's interested, it's on Shudder and you can watch it there.
Wow. Excellent. I remember how important Fangoria magazine was. I mean, that was that was such a huge, you know, back when magazines, you know, you got them and you read them and stuff. But that and probably Cine Fantastique were two of my favorite magazines to get every month. It was like, cannot wait, you know, kind of thing.
Well, and Starlog was the sci-fi equivalent of Fangoria.
Yeah. Yeah. But Cine Fantastique was so much better than Starlog.
It was, I think, more expensive.
Yeah, it was more expensive. That's true. True. Speaking of the sci-fi equivalent, so in my genre week, I did finally catch up on my Picard and finish it. So I finished the third season of that and the final season.
I'm breathless with anticipation.
It almost completely makes up for the other two seasons. As a matter of fact, I would recommend to people just watch the third season. If you are a Next Generation fan, or a Voyager fan, or a Deep Space Nine fan, watch the third season of Picard. And that's all you have to watch. You really don't have to see the other two. They're not connected, really. I mean, they are, and they try to force fit it near the end, but who cares? So it's really pretty impressive. You can tell that their new showrunner, I think his name is Metallus, I think is his name. You can tell that he definitely loved Next Generation a lot and really enjoys the homages without being, you know, hit you on the head with them and everything else. It's really good. Strong performances, great design work. Well,
from what I understand, the entire cast is back.
Yeah, essentially it's the, as he said after the series, and this isn't really giving anything away because people should know it by now. I mean, my God, it was last, you know, it was in the fall when it came out. But I mean, the winter. He says this is the 10-hour movie that the Next Generation cast deserved. That's what he calls it. And that was essentially his pitch to Paramount to do it and everything. And that makes sense. And it is. It's a huge love letter to Next Generation, basically. But it works. There are some issues I have with it, but I don't want to give anything away. I want people to watch it. And that would be one of the issues, yeah. You know, I am hoping that this is the coffin in the Borg saga, and we never hear the freaking term again.
What about Q?
I'm not going to go there either. It's not a smart thing. Anyway,
I gave up on that series in the first season. So
yeah. Yeah, well, it was a slog. I thought the first season had a lot of trouble. I thought the second season had a lot.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the first season back in the 1980s.
Oh, you got to skip the first two and just start on the third one.
Okay, whatever.
Ironically, that kind of works. So Next Generation, first two seasons don't work. Start with the third season. This one, start with the third season as well.
Okay. So. Well, that's David's advice, folks, for all you Star Trek Next Generation wannabe fans out there. Start with the third of both series.
Yes. Start with the third season and you'll be a lot better off.
I say watch Strange New Worlds and skip them all.
Yeah, well, excellent. Yes. Agreed.
So that leaves me with absolutely no segue into our movie of the day. Except
not really.
I'm trying to think. I talked about awards. This movie didn't win any. Well, I don't think it won any awards. Actually, it was nominated for an Academy Award.
Really? I can't wait to hear about that. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. We are going back into the horror world, so to speak, with a classic from 1945. And when I say classic, I'm more referring to the novel, which is by Oscar Wilde, and it is called The Picture of Dorian Gray. It is a black and white MGM movie from 1945, as I said. And basically, it is the story of a man who has a painting. Does he commission the painting? I think the guy just paints it because he's his muse.
Yes, he likes him a lot and wants to paint him.
Right. And in the book, it's a little bit more than what you see in the movie. The picture begins to age and the man does not. And the more the picture ages, the more morally decrepit and debaucherous the title character Dorian Gray becomes. This is, like I said, a 1945 movie, and they really can't go too deeply into the depravity, I guess you would say, of what Dorian gets to. So I don't know about you, but I did not find this movie scary at all. I was curious about your first impression, because I had never seen it before.
I am very familiar with the story because I remember reading the synopsis back when I was young, and I've seen various incarnations, so to speak, of that type of story, which we'll get to when we do the keys. But I'd never seen this movie before. I did not find the movie scary. I found it much more socially relevant or socially topical. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. It's very much an Oscar Wilde piece. I think I have not read the novel, so I can't really compare this to the novel, although I read a couple of reviews that said this, of all the variations or remakes or whatever that have been done, this was the closest to the novel that have been done. But that it's very Oscar Wilde. He liked to talk about society a lot. That's what he was known for. You know, he liked to be that rebel. He was the Harlan Ellison of his day. That's a huge key for me, you know, kind of thing.
I never really thought about that.
He liked to poke the bear a lot and make people think and wake them up about stuff and, you know, be snarky and aggravate them. But he was very eloquent with his dialogue. And there's a lot of that in this.
He's not known for science fiction or horror. This is the only piece that would fit into either, really. And
when it's his only fiction novel, right? It's his only novel that he wrote that's fiction. He wrote a couple of more, you know, nonfiction.
Yeah, I guess books. He just wrote plays. Maybe you're right. I hadn't really thought about that. Plays, I have read the book.
Yeah. Lots of poetry.
Mm-hmm. I read the book. The book goes, like I said, more into depth about some of the so-called depravity. He uses the word sensualism a lot, and that's kind of a code word for homoeroticism.
Well, that was going to be my first question. So is the novel more homoerotic than this? I mean, this is very, I think for 45, this is pretty much in your face homoerotic.
Well, it helps that Herb Hatfield was a gay person, and it speaks to me. I don't want anyone to come hunting for me because I am gay, but he has gay face, as a friend of mine on another podcast says.
Okay.
He just looks gay to me. And so I do think there is some homoeroticism in the film, notwithstanding the fact that the muse is kind of obsessed with him as well, the artist that is, that paints the picture. The book does have more of it in it, but it is still very disguised because you couldn't do it back then without being censored, because this book came out in the 19th century. Yeah, 19th century, exactly. Yeah. And shortly
Oscar Wilde went to jail.
Right.
For just being a homosexual. That was his crime.
Correct.
Which is ludicrous, but that's what it was.
And it's also a little bit of his own fault, because he knew what was coming and all his friends told him, you need to go to France. You need to get out of here. And he was like, oh, no, I'm not going. I'm from England. And they fucking locked him up. 2 years hard labor. Mm-hmm. And basically killed him, because when he got out, he immediately went to France, never went back to England, and died shortly thereafter of meningitis.
Yeah.
So, and he was very young. Yeah. I think he was like 46.
45, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So yeah. There is that history of Oscar Wilde, the man who wrote the original story. It's described as a philosophical novel.
Yeah.
So, I'll get to this when I get to my keys, but I mean, I see a lot of other stuff in it as well. It's a morality, so to speak. I would say a moral tale.
Yes. I mean, that's what he did best. That's what the importance of being earnest is, the same way. It's this look at Victorian England and the morals of the day and How can we, you know, turn them on their ear? How can we upset the apple cart? How can we do all these metaphors to make these, to have these people look at themselves? Mm-hmm. And how you may have all this pretension on top, but underneath you are a base human creature, or you are repressing your human desires kind of thing. You know, and there's the character of Lord Henry in this is that. That's what he is spouting the entire time.
He's my favorite.
It's really only about two-thirds of the way in that it suddenly twists into a, quote, more, to me, more of a mystery than a horror story. But, you know, the painting does start to turn, and he starts to do even more stuff and being less guilty about it, because the painting is taking all of his guilt away and all of his, you know, social morals kind of thing. And then they suddenly end, but they keep referring to, you know, Blue Gate Fields. You know, I've got that in my notes like three times, because that's the evilest of the evil places. Even when he tells the carriage guy that, the carriage guy gets all scared and doesn't want to take him there, you know. But the take I got on it from watching this movie for the first time was that's where all of the non-acceptable sexual practices take place. That's where all of the big opium drug dens are.
In the book, it's an opium den.
And doing some research on it, that is where, you know, that was the Upper East End of London, and that's where all the opium dens were. That's where basically you could get any kind of debauchery you wanted. So you could say, you know, here's a mule, go have fun for an hour or whatever.
Yeah, you know. And a lot of his debauchery came from breaking people down, you know, so to speak, making someone fall in love with him and then jilting them. That kind of thing. And I was like, this is a strange movie. Well, first of all, neither one of us have seen the movie. Did you like it?
Yeah, I actually did.
I liked it, but it was not as good as I thought it was going to be. It is definitely not a horror movie or a science fiction movie. I'm like, oh, we're going to be covering a movie that really doesn't fit either one of our genres.
Well, but, I think it tries to be a horror movie.
It does.
It does. You know, it tries to be a Jekyll and Hyde. It tries to be that kind of moral story and the evilness that's underneath you or within you kind of thing. You know,
I think it's MGM trying to be universal. It's what it looks like to me.
Yeah.
The reason I chose it is because it is categorized as a horror movie, and it's always won accolades, and it ranks 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. So I was like, this would be a good one for us to do from the 40s. So let's do it. I had seen it before, I probably would not have chose it, because it's not horror enough to me for what we do.
But I do think it's more horror than suspense. You know, I mean, think about it. I had my list of what was happening at the same time in this same year. So the same year this was released, you had Spellbound, which is a huge Hitchcock film. You had The Bells of St. Mary's. You had State Fair. You had And Then There Were None. The first version of And Then There Were None came out in 45. And those are all either thrillers or suspense or romance. So I think this doesn't fit into any of those categories.
No, so, but it's not really as good as any of those movies either, nor Mildred Pierce, which also came out that year.
I do like it better than Mildred Pierce. It's just me.
Mildred Pierce was up for more Oscars.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it had Oscar-worthy acting in it. I mean, George Sanders is good in it.
George Sanders, to me, steals every scene he's in. And every time he was on the television, I was interested. He was my favorite part about this movie.
I think a big structural difference, that's why I wanted to ask a question for you, is it in the book? A big structural problem I have with the movie is that Sir Henry goes away. For like the last third of the movie, he's not even there, really. And he really needs to be to counterpoint Dorian.
He's kind of like the narrator, yeah.
And so, that, yeah, we kind of hear this narrative voice,
yeah.
But we don't see, you know, him doing his you know, pontification like he has been, and his misogyny against women and all of this stuff about, you know, I've got like quotes and quotes and quotes because now I want to go read the book because some of the dialogue I love. Things like, I've got quotes like, there's no such thing as a good influence. Mm-hmm. There's only one thing in the world worth having, and that's youth. You know, always. Such a terrible word. Women use it more than men.
Yeah, it's very, well, I mean, Oscar Wilde was known for quotes, too.
Oh, yes. It's vocabulary, such wit. Very great dialogue.
Well, so I did some research on the movie because I was trying to figure out what it is about this movie that people like so much. And the director's name is Albert Lewin. He was born in 1894, shortly around the time or before the time Oscar Wilde died, and lived to 1968. He only directed 7 films. He wrote 19 and produced 17. But do you know anything about him?
No.
Well, he came out of the silent era, and that immediately clued me in. Oh, okay. Maybe that's another reason why this movie's not so great. But he got his master's at Harvard. He taught English at the University of Missouri. He served in World War I, was appointed to the Jewish Relief Committee, became a drama and film critic for the Jewish Tribune, went to Hollywood as a reader for Goldwyn, became a screenwriter at MGM, became head of the script department in the 1920s, and was Irving Thalberg's personal assistant and closest associate. When Thalberg died, When Thalberg died, he went to Paramount and became a producer. In 1942, he began to direct, and that's how this came about.
Wow.
I know. I'm like, this guy came out of nowhere. I mean, he did a lot, accomplished a lot, but not really a lot in film. He just knew people.
I loved his style. I thought he had some really cool stuff. He had some, you know, one of my keys is he had some early kind of Orson Welles feel to him.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like none of it was subtle. Okay, this is not a subtle movie in any way.
No.
But stuff like, you know, closing the big doors and suddenly the cat statue's in the foreground. Mm-hmm. And the camera slowly just kind of tilts up. So we're seeing the door on the third floor through the transom of the door. You know, that kind of stuff. All of the scenes, even like the first scene when they're in the carriage, he's in the carriage. That's a projection right beside him of the shadow of the cabman on the ground. That's a really cool little film trick that, you know, most people weren't doing in 45. So that was interesting.
Well, I mentioned that he was a writer as well, and he wrote this as well as directed it. He based it or adapted the Oscar Wilde novel into the screenplay. Oh, here's a few of the changes from the book to the movie. The romance between Gladys and David, some censorship restrictions that kept Dorian's unspeakable acts off screen. In the book, the picture alters in response to Dorian's good deed, but the alteration is ugly, reflecting his cynicism and self-serving motivation. He stabs the painting to destroy his conscience and eliminate the evidence. But in the film, he reads a faint change in the painting as a sign of hope, yet stabs the painting as if he can undo the past. He is transformed off-screen, very much like the Wolfman, and prays for forgiveness.
That's another effect I really liked was the painting transformation.
Well, what did you think about the color?
I loved it.
That was wild. I was not expecting that.
Did not expect it at all. And it was a very startling. The only issue I have with it is what the image you're showing right now, which is Dorian looking at his decrepit thing, and it's a 2-shot with him in it. Every other shot is just the painting in itself, and it's in color. Mm-hmm. I would have had it in color then, too. The painting should always be in color.
I see what you mean. Yeah. I agree. And nothing else. I didn't like that nothing you could else. See around the background in color, too.
Agreed. I did not like that. They just did a color plate kind of thing of it. And
it was very Wizard of Oz.
It should have just been the painting. Yeah.
Totally agree.
But it was startling and it was really neat. And I loved the transformation. After he stabs it and falls down, the whole, it looks like the oil is melting and swirling and moving. And that was a really cool effect because it was just in the frame. They didn't treat the whole picture that way. and then it restored to its original thing with still the knife in it, in the heart, which I thought was great. That was really cool. Oh, I gave the ending away. Oh, no. But, you know.
Oh, my God. It's only 100 and something years old.
Yeah, right.
Let's see. Scenes. I've already mentioned that any scene with George Sanders in it's my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think he's one of the best parts of this. Although there are other great actors in this movie.
The whole first scene is great. The scene with the next scene with Sanders when they're at the dinner party and the politician is there is great. And that's another one where I just took a ton of quotes on lines. We're interested in the poor to amuse ourselves, you know, was one line. And one should never regret one's mistake. No civilized man regrets a pleasure. And then his one with the politician. I apologize for the intelligence of my remarks. I forgot you were a member of Parliament. That is very Oscar Wilde to me.
Yes. And I don't. Yes. Sanders was just perfect for that.
Yes.
I always associate him with the Betty Davis movie, All About Eve.
Yeah, I liked. But the middle scenes, part kind of slows to me, I think, mostly because I could not, and maybe you can give me your opinion, but I could not decide if I liked Herd Hatfield or not.
I
couldn't decide if he's really a good actor or if he's a really wooden actor. I couldn't really tell. Is that a choice he's making to play him so straight all the time and so non-expressive, but extremely expressive with his eyes? But just not.
I don't think he's a good actor. I think it worked for the part, but I don't think he's a good actor. And also, if you look at his track record as far as other films, he didn't do anything else.
Well, then maybe that's why.
Right.
Then I mean,
he did and TV carrying, and stuff. But that's
again, I mean, like we said, him carrying the bulk of this middle section without Sir Henry was an issue, I think.
I agree. Totally.
And then I did like all of the not debauchery, but all the Blue Gate Field scene, you know, when Sylvie's brother comes looking for him and the other drunk is there drawing his chalk picture on the table and all of that, the piano player. I love those scenes. I thought they were
cool. Oh, my God. It looked exactly like the bar from Dark Shadows, the soap opera.
It may have been.
I can't think of what the name of that bar is now, and it's going to piss me off because I'll be thinking about it from here on out. But it reminds, because it was on the seafront, you know, on the wharf or whatever.
Yeah.
And had sailors, and it was very debaucherous or whatever. But also, you know, Maggie and Barnabas would go there and have a drink.
Of course. Why not? Vampires hang out here all the time.
Right. But yeah, I agree. I think the guy that played James is one of the strongest actors in here. Richard Frazier is the guy that played her brother.
Yes, he's strong. I felt the use of piano all the way through it was really cool. I loved the selections of songs they picked, the Chopin and the Mozart, mm-hmm. and the references to Don Giovanni, which is very, you know, apropos for this.
Mm-hmm. Back to scenes, though, one of the scenes that really impressed me was the one with Angela Lansbury where he's trying to tell her he wants her to spend the night.
The test.
Yeah. Yes. And you just, she does everything with her eyes. This is her third movie. She had done Gaslight and one other popular movie, and then this was her next movie. She had not been around very long. And she's great in this.
Yeah, she is really strong in this. And that's a great scene. That whole, he's doing the test because Henry challenged him to do the test. So he's doing it. And it's that the key to that is like that whole be careful what you wish for sort of thing, because it cuts to the next morning. And we definitely know they slept together. But he is writing the letter that tells her
that he's
stay away from me.
Yeah.
I don't love you anymore. Blah, blah, blah.
See ya. Bye.
Right. Then the next day, he's decided he does love her. He's going to go see her, and it's perfect, and yada, yada, and finds out she killed herself.
She's killed herself.
Yeah.
Because of his debauchery. Yeah. It's so,
well,
a little overplayed, but yeah.
He destroyed her. In Victorian England, he destroyed her, you know. You can't be sleeping around with men.
It's funny that you mentioned his, whether or not he's a good actor or not, but I'm looking at those two pictures behind me and his expression is the exact same in both pictures.
Yes.
It's like that's his what face I meant. Doesn't move.
Is that a choice he made or did they have just massive amounts of Botox even back then?
That's what I was going to say. Maybe they were trying to say, you know what? Your face is a painting. Don't move it. You're forever young. I don't know.
Maybe.
That's me trying to be funny. Any other scenes? I can't really think of any except for the end when he snaps the painting, maybe.
Well, both of the toy room scenes I liked. I liked him killing Basil and the way it happened. The swinging light, very psycho and all that kind of thing. I liked that.
Oh,
and
I liked, okay. Yeah.
And I liked him doing, you know, so the murder of Basil I liked. And I liked him, you know, the murder of himself, essentially. His
right. Stabbing the painting.
Ending. Mm-hmm. And I thought Peter Lawford did a great job in all of his scenes, too. You could tell he will be a star. You could see how strong he was. As an actor, I love that. Again, I've got it in my notes. I love one of the lines when he comes out and sees that David is up trying to get in his, you know, his attic toy room door where he keeps the painting.
Yeah, it's like, bitch, quit going through my stuff. Get away from that door.
He comes down there and he goes, I was just taking a tour of your house. It's quite fascinating. It's better than a museum. And he goes, you know, obviously, since you keep that room locked, you must have something great stored in there. What do you have stored in there? And he goes, skeletons of inquisitive guests. And I thought, okay, that's actually witty and funny, too. So I really like that line.
Well, yeah, because Lawford's kind of an asshole in it. But he's in love with the Donna Reed character. I can't think of her name.
Gladys.
Yeah. And Gladys, we meet as a little girl in the very beginning when the picture's being painted. So she has grown up and become a woman. And of course, Dorian has not aged whatsoever while everyone else around him is now old.
And of all the people in the world, she's not the one that brings that the frick up.
You would think.
Seems like she remembers sitting in his lap and he looked the same way.
But David, she's always been in love with him ever since she was a little girl.
Well, okay, that's fine. But he used to be, you know, Uncle Dorian, and now he's Dorian.
Maybe she's into hot old guys that's faces don't move. I don't know. Hot old guys that look young and have no expression. How about that?
Yeah, because, you know, it's all about morals. So, yeah. She could not have.
I think it's funny that you usually, if I don't like the movie and you like it, it's sci-fi. And this time I don't like it and it's horror.
Well, rare. But to your point, it's really not horror, or you would probably like it.
Right. Right.
You know, it's just... And I seem to remember, I was going to look it up and I didn't, but I seem to remember because this movie, this novel, has been remade several times. But I seem to remember a Twilight Zone that was,
or
a Night Gallery that was this. It wasn't Pickman's model. Pickman's model, I think, is a key from this, the Lovecraftian one. But I seem to remember like a Night Gallery that did their version of Dorian Gray. But I don't know. And I think that's the first time I ever got turned on to it. But for some reason, I'm thinking that, but I didn't get a chance to do research and find out. So.
I mean, there's several movies of it and television movies as well. I don't know that I've ever seen any. And the reason I chose this is because you can go to Rotten Tomatoes and you can put the word Dorian Gray in there and you can look at them all lined up beside each other, ranked. And this one is always number one. And I'm like, okay, well, this is the one we should do. And I don't know.
I saw there was a 1973 version. Which looks very television and very, right. I think it was done on television.
Yeah. Michael York in it or something? It's some guy that looks like Michael York.
Looks like that, but I didn't think it was Michael York, but it looked like him. There was a remake. I mean, there was a version that the BBC did that starred Jeremy Brett that looked pretty cool. They did it as a two-parter, like a, you know, of 2 hour, you know, movie of the week kind of thing. And then I saw there was a 2009 version with Ben Barnes.
I think I remember that.
Is a great actor. That would be really cool. But I don't know if I want to watch it now because if it's not going to be better than this.
It's all subjective, but I'm just going by rankings on a review website. And it would have included those as well. And they fell below this. Before I move on to cast, I was going to mention something else about the book. Oh, well, it was originally commissioned along with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and like Edgar Rice Burroughs by a magazine that wanted to print novellas by the three authors. And he was late. The other two got theirs in really quickly. Oscar got his in and moved on. And the magazine cut lots of the stuff out of it that they thought was not suitable without telling him. So there have been, what I was getting to is there's been several versions of the book. That was the original that got edited out. Then there was the book he put out, and I think it may have had some edits. And then there's like a final version that not only includes his preferred text, but it also has those excised pages from that original novella that was printed in the magazine. So it's got like a lot of that stuff. So there, to go back to your original question, there is some quote debauchery. Now, we don't even consider homosexuality to be debauchery, but back then it was. So I guess that was some of the stuff that was cut. Definitely some stuff between him and Basil. Basil had it for him pretty badly in the book, if I remember right, for Dorian.
I think you could tell that a little bit in this, but he's, you know, treated as like you're the artist. He's the artist and this is the muse. Mm-hmm. You know, Basil has obviously been married because he has it. Isn't that his daughter? Isn't Gladys his daughter? Yeah. Gladys is his daughter or niece. I can't remember.
You know what? It may have been his niece. I can't remember either.
But they have the same last name. So something in there. I think I find it interesting that the majority of the story deals with Dorian essentially pursuing two women. And then there's also a montage sequence where the narrator talks about other women who, after they've spent time with Dorian, start avoiding him and everything. So, but then there's this layer of homoeroticism over it, you know, is so Dorian is bisexual or pansexual or something. I don't know.
But well, it's Victorian England, so he's none of those.
He's evil and debaucherous is what he is.
Right. I guess I should go on in the cast, because one of the things this movie does have going for it is a lot of great acting. Namely, to me, George Sanders is in this. He plays Lord Henry Wotton. I think he is hilarious. We know him primarily from The Jungle Book. He played Shere Khan, the tiger.
He's Shere Khan. Yeah.
Right. So, I guess that's one of the reasons why he's my favorite in the movie, because I love that movie. He was an Englishman born in Russia. He was also in the movie Rebecca and All About Eve, which I mentioned.
Yep.
But do you know, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, I can't remember what context it was in, but do you know about his death?
No.
Okay, he killed himself. I'm not laughing because he killed himself. I'm laughing because, he killed himself with pills in 1972. He told his friend David Niven that he intended to do this when he got older, and he left a note. And it said, "Dear world, I am leaving because I am bored. I feel I have lived long enough. I am leaving you with your worries in this sweet cesspool. Good luck." And that was it.
There you go.
So talk about Dorian Gray, man. I don't think this guy wanted to get old. He was 65 when he did it.
Can't knock him for that kind of intention there.
You know, I just remembered the guy I'm thinking about that we talked about that killed himself with someone else, and I cannot think of his name. He was in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I can't think of his name now, but we talked about him, and he killed himself too. You remember things like that when an actor kills himself.
You do.
Okay, Herd Hatfield, pretty much forever associated with this role. The only thing else I showed him doing was television stuff. I did do a little deep diving and found that he was notoriously known for being a homosexual. Of course, he was not out at the time. So I think that's why we get a lot of gay vibe from him, because he actually was gay. Donna Reed is in this movie. I think she's a little out of place because most of the people in this movie are British. and she's not.
Yeah, I had a big trouble with that. I mean,
well, Heard's not British either. Accent. Yeah, Heard's not a British either. He's an American. But Donna Reed, of course, we know her from It's Wonderful Life and from Here to Eternity, and mostly for the Donna Reed Show, where she went on to inspire songs like Somewhere That's Green from Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, I kept thinking, no, you don't need to be with Dorian Gray. You need to be with Jimmy Stewart.
That's George Bailey.
George Bailey, come on now.
So, yeah. Well. Anyway, Angela Lansbury, as I said, it's in this movie. It's her third film. She is a wonderful actress and a dame that we just lost last year. She was most known, obviously, for Murder, She Wrote. But as I mentioned, she did Gaslight. She was in The Manchurian Candidate, as well as Mrs. Potts in Beauty and the Beast and Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd.
For me, she will always be Mrs. Lovett. I love her in that role. It was brilliant. Some of the best.
It's hard to picture anybody else but her in that role, I think.
Yeah, the new girl who's doing it on Broadway now is very good, and she's strong, and she's, but I feel like she's intentionally not trying to do Angela Lansbury is her gag, and that kind of throws me off even worse.
No, you need a really thick Cockney accent, even in the song.
Well, and you also need that comic timing she has. You know, like you said, she tells so much with her eyes and the way she's so expressive. And she did that as Lovett very, very well. And so it's interesting to see someone else try to mount that role.
Well, and that guy that played opposite her as Sweeney, I can't see anyone else but him in that role, too.
Oh, George Heard?
I can't think of his name. He was more of a stage actor, but yeah.
Yeah, he was very stage actor. I don't think he ever did a film. But yeah, he was very great in that as well. Yeah, it's hard to see someone else. And now the new guy is, what's his name? The musician, the singer, is playing it on Broadway now.
Josh Groban. No. Yeah. Every time I hear about it, I'm like, I don't want to see it.
Now, I've heard him sing, and a couple of the songs sound good, pretty good. They're still not Heard quality, but they're good. But I can't imagine him doing it visually.
No.
I just don't.
No. But I do find this funny that, like Explorers, we talked about Joe Dante's movies other than Explorers. And now, in this movie, we're talking about Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, true. Which is scary, by the way.
It is scary. It's much more of a horror movie than this is. It is. And I'm not talking about the Johnny Depp one.
No.
Okay. You mentioned Peter Lawford played David Stone. He is in love with the Gladys character and the one that's trying to break into Dorian's locked room. Peter was known as a rat hacker.
Yes.
He, you know, was a member with Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Joey Bishop, Sammy Davis Jr., all those guys.
Yep.
He was a prolific working actor. I went through his entire resume and there's really nothing of note, but there's a ton of it. I mean, he did so much.
Yeah.
So like you said, he was fine. Lowell Gilmore played Basil Howard, and Howard. I have nothing on Lowell.
Okay.
Richard Fraser, who I mentioned I like, played James Vane, the Sybil character's brother. And he was in the movie Bedlam with Boris Karloff. And that's one of my favorite Boris Karloff movies. That's probably on our list. And then Douglas Walton is a Canadian actor that played Alan Campbell. Who was Alan? I can't remember.
Okay, I have that coming. I'm glad you got there because I have that in my notes. In the novel, is there more explanation of Alan Campbell? He's the scientist that Dorian asks to come to him and get rid of the body.
Yes.
And he threatens him with something that's written on a letter that we never see. The guy shoots himself. Later on.
Right. I don't remember if he's any more prominent in the book, but yes, he is the scientist that knows how to make a body rapidly decompose. And basically, Dorian bribes him or blackmails him into getting rid of Basil's body. And he has something on him. I can't. Yeah, I don't know if you know what that is.
We needed more of whatever that was, you know.
Right, because either, that's part of the debauchery.
Right. Either do this or I tell them about the horse. You know, it would have been enough. Something, you know. You know, it needed... I mean, obviously, the guy, actually, I thought the actor did a great job of just, you know, I hate being here. I don't want to be here. And
it's just totally one scene. Down, yeah.
Totally breaking down when he gives him the letter and says, I've already got a letter ready to mail unless you do this and yada, mm-hmm. yada, you know. And then later on, that's part of the list that Dorian lists at the end of the things that he's done wrong is led to that guy's suicide. But yeah, Alan Campbell.
Alan Campbell. And also Adrian Singleton. Do you remember who Morton Lowry was in this movie? I don't remember who he was.
Morton Lowry. Was he the Parliament guy?
Maybe. I don't think he was that old. Anyway, I just have in my notes that he was in How Green Was My Valley and The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Okay.
I don't remember who he played, but it was obviously down the list. So that's all I have on cast. But I wanted to get to awards because this movie won awards.
Wow.
This movie won an Academy Award. It won a Golden Globe and it won a Hugo.
Okay.
For Academy Awards, it was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Lansbury. It was nominated for Best Art Direction. But it won for cinematography. So you mentioned something about a camera shot earlier. Well, guess what? It won an Academy Award.
It deserves that. There's a lot of great cinematography in this movie.
Right. And to what I said, Angela Lansbury won a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress. And I could see that because I think she's great in this.
Yeah, she is. And I think she's better than Donna Reed. Donna Reed's fine, but she doesn't have a lot to do. Angela's more expressive in her sequences and scenes.
Right. Yeah.
I just looked up a thing that said that 1973 version that I saw was produced by Dan Curtis.
It does not surprise me at all.
He may have used the same Dark Shadows.
The Dark Shadows bar is in that movie too. I guarantee it. I wish I could think of the name of it. It's got such a funny name, and I can't think of the name of it.
But I mean, you were talking about cinematography. Think alone of that, you know, of the murder scene. And the whole thing is done with that swinging lantern and that, you know, and the way the light changes on Dorian's face and everything, and the way it changes on the painting. It's a really cool scene, the way it's shot.
It's called The Blue Whale. That's the name of that bar.
Okay, The Blue Whale. There you go. As it should be near the wharf, as it is. So, but it's not called that in this. In this, it's just it's essentially the area where they go. They all end up in that one Blue Gate Fields sort of place.
So it won a Best Dramatic Presentation for the Hugo Awards.
Okay.
And it's not even science fiction. Why would the Hugo Awards give it?
I don't know why it would win a Hugo. I could understand it winning like a Raven or something for horror, for a novella.
A Bram Stoker, but they weren't around. Bram Stoker only has been around since the 1990s, those awards. But Hugos have been around for a long time. So maybe they were lumping horror back into their stuff back then. I don't know. In the 40s?
Maybe, because it's the 40s. So, yeah.
I would have to do more research.
Frankenstein was science fiction. So,
well, Frankenstein is science fiction, though.
Yeah, but this is horror because it's supernatural. There's a ghost in the painting, dude. The painting is transforming. So,
okay. Best movie to be adapted potentially by Ray Bradbury. I don't know. Okay. This movie is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list. And with that, I concur.
Yeah, I can agree with that one. Yep.
And
yeah, I think it's fine. I would watch it, you know, in the same setting as Wolfman or any of those 40s kind of, you know, quasi horror movies sort of thing. But yeah,
I'm glad I watched it because I had never seen it. I will probably never watch it again. However, I would watch Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, any of those again. So
true. And you're the horror fan. So, you know, you're the expert on that.
Before we move on to keys, do you have any other trivia?
I like the set design in this. You know, yeah, a lot of the sets are really, really impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of prop work in this that really means nothing. You know, there's a great scene where Gladys is talking to him and he is going from cabinet to cabinet and just pulling out these little ornate boxes and opening them up and then closing them while he's talking to her. And he opens it up and finally the last one, he pulls out the necklace, you know, that he gives her. And I'm like going, what? That made no, it's great, but.
You just reminded me of something that I forgot that I was going to mention is maybe Herb Hatfield was not a good actor because he cannot act like he is playing piano. It looks so fake every time he is attempting to play piano. He's just kind of doing this.
Yep. And it's the exact opposite. They're playing the lowest tones and he's way over here on the left.
It's
and
terrible. You know,
that's the high. Have you ever sat at a piano and just hit a key?
Right.
You know, high's up here, low's down here. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And why would the director or anybody else on set let him do that?
Not say something. Right. Because it just looks bad. It does. It looks really, really bad.
I have the Two Turtles is the 1945 version of Britain's Got Talent because it starts out with the little guys in the xylophone puppets. And then suddenly she comes on and they're dousing her with freaking paper snow the whole time.
I know, just totally, totally dumping that fake snow on her. And that was something else I meant to mention earlier is that it is not vaudeville in the novel. It's Shakespeare and they're watching Romeo and Juliet and she's Juliet.
Ah, well, I guess that change was probably because of
the time,
the way vaudeville was looked down on. It's not real theater. It's vaudeville kind of thing, you know.
To add some debauchery. That's my favorite word to say today, by the way.
He can't be over. Well, as soon as he stands there, the guy goes, patrons of the Two Turtles, we are graced with a gentleman this evening. You know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
What are you calling the rest of us, buddy?
Serfs.
You know, or whatever. Right, right. You're obviously all homosexuals, and he is a good man from uptown.
And murderers.
He's murderer. You're murderers and murderers.
Oh, my God. Several years after this movie premiered, a friend of Herd's bought the painting of the young Dorian Gray that was used in this movie at an auction and gave it to him. On March 21st, 2015, this portrait was put up for auction at Christie's in New York from the collection of Robert Hatfield Ellsworth. I wonder if that was his husband. I don't know. Maybe. Anyway, with an auction estimate of between $5,000 and $8,000, it sold for $149,000. So that's, that painting's, and back to, the painting itself. Both those paintings were commissioned from two different artists. Did you read about this?
No.
The title painting used at the end of the film, I guess that's the scary one. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The one at the end of the film was painted by Ivan Le Lorraine Albright, an American artist who was well known as a painter of the macabre and created specifically for use in this film. It is now a part of the art collection at the Institute of Chicago, the Art Institute of Chicago. So you can see that in Chicago if anyone out there is interested. It is a very cool painting, but you could see the other one. I thought
they did great makeup on the dead body laying there, on Dorian's body. That was a good shot.
That was the only horrific thing in this movie.
If he had looked like Mr. Sardonicus or whatever, it would have scared the crap out of me.
Well, I just wish I had found a picture of it to put on this podcast behind me so that there would be something scary that we could talk about. But Keys. Most of mine are classical. You've got more modern stuff, I think.
I think you have to key the novel, of course, because that's what it's based on. And I think you have to key Faust. I mean, come on. It's a deal with the devil. That's basically the major key to this.
That was my major key. The German legend of Faust, which is mostly known by the plays by Christopher Marlowe and by Goethe. Those are the only two. I knew more of the Christopher Marlowe one from school. And Marlowe, you know, is like, Shakespeare. I mean, he's old.
Yeah.
He old.
I have an allusion, of course, to Twilight Zone, just because, like I said, it's either Twilight Zone or Night Gallery, and they had a version of it. But also, so much of Serling's twists are based on The Deal with the Devil. I mean, Monkey's Paw and all of that kind of stuff are this thematic of be careful what you wish for, or, you know, you want to, oh, I want to be a librarian. I want the rest of the world to go away so I can read. Oh, my glasses are broken. You know, be careful what you wish for kind of feel all the way through it.
I get the sense of irony with the Twilight Zone, but I have to point out, as far as Night Gallery, they are walking around a bunch of paintings in this movie.
Right.
Agreed. I mean, that's kind of what happens a lot.
Yep.
They stand in front of paintings.
And the paintings are some kind of representation of the story in Night Gallery.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But you've got, you know, you've also got Pickman's Model, which is, again, one of my keys, which is, and that's about a guy who is painting the demons that he sees. And they're so horrible that they almost drive people mad when they see the paintings. So it's, again, this, the painting is integral to the story. So much so that Pickman at the end of it actually is taken to hell by the demons, you know, kind of thing. The monsters,
you know,
literal monsters.
You just reminded me of something. I cannot think of what the story or novel is, but Barker has done this too. Clive Barker has done this theme before.
I know. Oh, yeah.
And he's an artist. So
Monkey's Paw is there, you know, and King has done a Monkey's Paw version. But I'm sure that there's an original for Bradbury. You know, the whole thing about Something Wicked This Way Comes is, what do you wish for? And you have to pay for it. You know, the lady wants to be young again, but she goes blind. You know, the football player wants to relive his football days, but he's a kid, you know, kind of thing. So it's all this cautionary morality tale of be careful, you know, what you wish.
But as far as morality, I mean, there's a lot of morality in Stephen King. The one that comes to mind immediately is Needful Things.
Yep.
Where the guy comes to town and basically gives people what they want in exchange for their soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would definitely put Needful Things.
You definitely have to see Basil and Sir Henry in this as good and evil. Basil is, I love you so much, I want to paint you. And you're my muse and you're my inspiration. And he's the one that's giving him the book on Buddha. He's the one that's saying, be careful, Dorian, you know, yada, yada, all that. And Sir Henry is the
devil,
you know, the devil. Give in to your wildest desires. Pleasure is all that is important. Yada, yada. All
these you know what? And there's a French book they always make allusion to in the novel. That's like this, the most debaucherous text you could possibly read. I'm sure it's like the Marquis de Sade, but they don't use that name.
Right.
And I can't
remember. Well, is that what the quote's from? Because, you know, the beginning and the end is the quote of I am heaven and hell.
I assumed it was fictitious and that was an Maybe. Oscar Wilde quote, but I don't know.
Probably. Yeah. Probably. Well, I have Psycho, of course, you know, this whole swinging light thing. Which is very psycho kind of
thing. Well, and Norman Bates seemed all innocent, and he wasn't.
I have Beauty and the Beast. Because not only Lansbury, but Beauty and the Beast is about an enchantment. This guy is cursed with this enchantment of, in Beast's thing, it's the flower. And when the flower goes away, you will die. You will be gone. This one, the painting is enchanted and it's taking all of his vice away from
him. Totally makes sense. Yes.
You know, I can see that. I've also got Penny Dreadful because the character is totally recreated in the second season of Penny Dreadful. And it's great. He's a great character and everything he does is really cool in that series that came on. And that whole Gothic restoration series, which was.
I could see them actually. He was a character in that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he is a character. Dorian Gray is in Penny Dreadful.
Sorry, I blanked out because I've only seen part of that. I've seen like one season.
Dude, you need to watch that whole thing. It's
Because I do remember Dorian Gray being a character on there at one point.
Oh, yeah.
I love how they mix all that stuff up. Yeah.
Frankenstein, Wolfman, all of it's in there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've got Don Giovanni because Don Giovanni is the same story. It's Faust. He's selling his soul to the devil kind of thing. And then Interview with a Vampire because of the temptation of the young kind of thing. The whole beginning of this was very...
Drink for me and live forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sleep with Lestat. Me and live forever.
Yeah. There you go. Give in to your desires and we'll be right. We'll live forever. Mm-hmm. And then my last one is
you had a bunch.
It's weird, but it's Larry Gelbart and Robin Williams, that whole kind of wit kind of writing, you know, all that MASH writing and that early 70s sitcom writing, which is all this very, you know, a Norman Lear, all of that whole thing of I'm going to cloak my views on morality in all this wit and humor. And even though I'm living a lot of the stuff that everybody in society is saying is bad, it's not. And I'm going to show you through my wit, which was Oscar Wilde, very much so. And I think it is still Larry Gelbart, Norman Lear, Robin Williams, all of them trying to make these societal statements through comedy, which is a very Oscar Wilde thing to me. He was the first to really do that, I think, more so than even Shakespeare. Because he made a statement of living it. Shakespeare kind of went, I'm just an actor and a playwright. I don't care. You know, Oscar Wilde is, you know, had the long hair, the clothes, the flamboyance, everything. Mm-hmm. He was saying, come and get me about it.
Right.
Attitude wise.
And yeah. He should have went to France. I bet he wished he went to France.
He should have. Really. Mm-hmm. I would love to have seen what he would have done in later years.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. For sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, my final key is Oscar Wilde himself. Well, Duff.
Good. Yeah.
He wrote in a letter in 1894 that the picture of Dorian Gray contains very much of me in it. Basil Hallward is what I think I am. Lord Henry is what the world thinks of me. And Dorian is what I would like to be.
Wow, that's cool. Where did you find that quote? That is awesome.
I don't know. I think I lifted it. Lifted it off the internet somewhere.
Wow, that's interesting. That's really, I could see that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, he just put himself into it big time. In all those characters. I mean, you can hear him in Lord Henry. You can hear him.
Oh, yes.
Oscar. I mean, not Oscar.
In Dorian.
Dorian's what I meant to say. Sorry.
Yeah, when you read Wilde's letters and his critiques and his poetry and everything, I mean, it is this. He's definitely had a voice and a very unique voice that unfortunately, you know, ended too early.
Ended too early. And we have run on a little late. So how would you sum this up?
I would think I disagree with you in that I probably would watch it again. I do think it has some strong moralistic tales. I think it's very interesting to see how you tell a kind of pulpy story in a more refined way kind of thing. And I do think it's worth it just for Sanders and some of the cinematography.
Yeah, I would like to see a modern remake of it.
I would too. Very
a lot
much.
Of the stuff is intact and in there.
And but I just wish we had David Bowie to play the lead because he would have been great to play Dorian.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. Because he didn't look old until the very end. Bowie always looked young. Yeah.
Always. And it would have been interesting to tie that story together.
I would, if it's on and I'm flipping channels, I may watch it. It's not something I would go out of my way to watch. There are other things with George Sanders in it that I would much rather watch.
Like Jungle Book.
Yeah. Or Psychomania.
Well, all of you out there listening and watching us, that's what Tim and I think. We would love to hear what you guys think. Please let us know. Have you seen Dorian Gray? Are there better versions of Dorian Gray? Did you see the Dan Curtis one? And what do you think of that? Or what do you think of what we've said about this? The keys that we mentioned? Do you agree, disagree, all that? If you're new, again, please subscribe down there. That way you'll get alerts on all of our upcoming stuff. Visit the website where you can see all of our past episodes. And consider becoming a patron in at Patreon, because that, A, helps support us and we can continue doing this. But also you get some really cool stuff, not only other episodes and special episodes that we do just for our Patreon guests, but also we have two other podcasts there and video channels. One is the Dilithium Chamber, which is the original series of Star Trek. And the other one is X-Files Declassified, which is X-Files. And Tim, until next time, when we'll be still in some dated stuff, but we'll be more science fiction-y.
We're going to the Blue Whale, right? With Barnabas.
Yeah,
and we're going
to hang out with Barnabas and see what happens. Yeah. I'll see you then.
All right. Bye.